generous and non-specific introduction. I have always been nervous of elaborate and specific introductions. Ever since I gave my first public speech, I was a cub instructor at a little college out in California, and I went into the front office one day when I'd only been on the campus a few weeks, and the president said to me, "Boy, am I glad to see you. The Rotary Club has just called up. They need a speaker this noon on your way." And I drove down the hill to San Pedro and was trying to think of something to say and went in, and one of the senior members of the club introduced me. And he went on and on and on and on, and he said more kind things about me than had ever been said about anybody. And finally, it was my turn, and I stood up and I said, "Thank you." And he jumped right back up again. And he said, "Sonny, don't let it go to your head. Please remember that it is the weak product that needs the full-page color ad." Ever since the board meeting yesterday, I've been a little nervous about what I was going to say, because there was the suggestion that the speakers at these meetings should be dealing with theory rather than getting polemical. And I spent some time last night kind of fretting about that, and then I decided, well, I am not the quiet type. They must have known what they were doing when they invited me, and I'm going to go ahead and be me. And either your program chairman made a mistake or he didn't. You'll find out. I do want to apologize to Bill Baruti, because much of what I have to say was presented in a debate for him in January. He can go out and take a third cup of coffee or something.
He left, of course.
You can't ever get ahead of that guy. Text. On most campuses, the academic engine runs fairly smoothly. The people get hired, the students graduate, the money gets raised so that it can be put in, and scholarly work's turned out. The president gives speeches and attends to dinners, donors, deans, alumni, corporate executives, foundation officers, government officials, and visiting dignitaries. He's busy, 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 cheering up and chastising, funding, facilitating, moderating, mediating, reviewing budgets and building plans, socializing and speechifying, until he is tired and resigns, or tired and retired. This description was not chosen at random. I think I have listed most of the main activities of the typical college or university president. And if that is the case, the man I have described is a professional manager rather than an academic leader. I believe higher education is blessed with many able administrators and is cursed by a dearth of true academic leaders and even fewer educational statesmen. The failure in leadership, as I see it, stems from a failure to understand the mission of education. Lacking that understanding, the presiding officer can hardly be effective in coordinating the efforts of his associates or meeting the tough and complex challenges that will always confront any human agency, or maintaining the integrity of the institution he serves. I will speak to the fundamental failure of understanding and the three vital failures which issue from it: failure to enlist cooperation toward common goals, failure to meet difficult new challenges, and failure to protect the integrity and independence of the institution. You understand, present company accepted. Because the mission I have set for myself today is extensive, this will be more a bill of particulars than a speech. But I believe this is the best means for attending to such a comprehensive failure. First, the failure to understand the objectives of education. In this nation, we have a naive and uncritical faith in the educational process. We have the silly idea that all will be well if we can simply coax or shove all the people through an educational machine which is characterized by high salaries, small classes, well-stocked libraries, well-equipped laboratories, and the proper racial mix. It happens that we have more of all of these things than any society has ever known before. And as we have gone on getting more of these things, we have seen an increasing disintegration of this society. It's coming unglued at the seams. Day before yesterday, I read the newest report of crime statistics issued by the federal government. We're always impressed with statistics in this country. We had the magnificent increase of 50% in the number of robberies committed in New York City during a one-year period. You can go on with the increasing rates of dope addiction, divorce, alcohol, suicide, you know them all. But I suggest that more of the same education is obviously not the answer. What is believed to be the mission of higher education? The U.S. Office of Education has done a wonderful thing, and I want to say that praise comes hard from these lips. But it has completed a three-year study of 7,500 professors and administrators at 68 non-denominational university campuses, asking all of those people to identify what are the objectives of the university and what should be the objectives of the university. On the tabulated results, we discover an interesting thing. The number one objective of the university is and should be, by a very wide margin, to protect the academic freedom of the faculty. It might seem that that would be a means instead of an end, but that is the number one objective by an overwhelming majority, is and should be. You read down both lists, is and should be, and in the first 10 on either list, you don't find anything whatever, not one item, that suggests that the student is at the far end of the educational process other than as a unit of intellectual raw material. The student is considered as a disembodied intellect, which is to be sharpened and honed and may be directed to any end. By the orthodoxy of higher education in this country, the university is just as willing to turn out an Adolf Hitler as an Albert Schweitzer. You read the inaugural address of the new chair president of the Association for Higher Education, and he said that whether the student is boozing all night or breaking laws or whatever is of no concern whatever to the educational institution. One of the popular books among young people today is a novel by the German existentialist Hermann Hesse, in which he equates good with evil. And it makes no difference which way you go so long as you do it all the way. The orthodoxy in higher education is that knowledge is self-justifying. And the intellectual activity is a high virtue, no matter what the consequences. Incidentally, that there is a book which summarizes this study of the Office of Education, and it's must reading. It's entitled University Goals and Academic Power, compiled by Gross and Gramsch. Again, if you study the official orthodoxy of the mission of the university, we discover that the highest good is for the faculty members. Say, is this thing squealing? Yes. What can we do about it? Are there any technicians in the School of Intellect? It's like a cobra. If you go further into the official definition of higher education, the highest good is for the faculty member to do his own thing without any limits and without any regard for anybody else. It's not surprising that the bright students have got the message. You do your own thing without any limits and without regard to anybody else. The university that chooses that as its definition is obviously hoist by its own petard. There is no justifiable defense against the activities of malefactors. I suggest that education has traditionally had a double mission. That on the one hand, it is to create new knowledge, transmit it to the young, and develop the intellectual powers of the young. And on the other hand, it is to try to produce graduates who can live responsibly, and creatively in the society which provides the educational system. The latter purpose has been officially rejected in this country by much of higher education since World War II. If in a professional meeting you raise the question of character education, there's a great intake of breath and a state of shock, expressions of scorn and derision. That is not an exaggeration. Education cannot be apart from society. It must support it. The very concept of trustee or regent recognizes that society has the primary stake in education. And the trustees and regents are supposed to be drawn from the brightest, most responsible members of society. And it is their job, their responsibility, to see that education indeed serves society. Education in a free society must, of course, attend to opposing views. But it must do so in a creative way. Institutions of higher learning, for heaven's sake, should be setting an example of civility and rationality in dealing with conflicting concepts, and not set an example of coercion and emotion and violence in dealing with conflicting concepts. There is a devastating, in my judgment, misunderstanding of the meaning of academic freedom. Much of the academic community treats it as if it were an absolute. It is, of course, not an absolute. It is an ideal. Every university has certain limits in concentric frameworks. I have yet to meet a university administrator who would tolerate murder in the name of academic freedom. I have yet to meet a university administrator who wouldn't fire, tenure or not, a professor of physics who uses physics classes to teach French literature. I don't care how good he is in French literature. Further, there are additional limits available to every college or university, and these limits are sustained by the Civil Liberties Union, the AAUP, and the Regional Accrediting Association. Any college can set any limits it chooses, which will help that institution fulfill its purposes. The only obligation is to make those special limits known to professors and students and others before they come to the institution. Principia College perfectly, reasonably, and rightly limits its enrollment, its professors, and its other employees to members of the Christian Science faith. It has every reason to do so. Within that special framework, it has a very lively educational institution, academic freedom, and the rest. I say the president must be the first scholar of the faculty, that his field must be educational theory, and the interaction of the educational institutions with society, and the creative attention on the part of the educational institution to the most pressing problems of society. Buckminster Fuller said an interesting thing recently. He said, in our educational institutions, we have developed a system which is self-subversive. That at the undergraduate level, we identify the brightest minds, we get them on into graduate studies, and make specialists out of those brightest minds, thereby leaving the dunderheads to be the generalists who become the college presidents, the corporate presidents, and the high officers of government. We have no means in this country of identifying the brightest minds and taking them on to make them comprehensivists, which certainly educational leadership requires. Failing thus to understand the mission of education, the next failure is in coordinating the work of the constituencies toward the fulfillment of that mission. One of the primary responsibilities of educational leadership is to conduct a continuing program of education for the trustees, to help them understand what is at stake in the issues which they must decide at the policy level. On our campus for 9 years, we've had the trustees meeting with 30 student leaders for dinner once a year, and the students choose the agenda topics. Now, a lot of college presidents think one of their responsibilities is to keep the trustees as far apart as they can from the faculty and students. This is nonsense. Sure, the students, and when we do it later in the year with the faculty, are going to say the things that are on their minds, and a certain amount of this is going to be abrasive, but these trustees are not children. They have to know firsthand what's involved in the issues they discuss. The wise college president will bring into the trustee meetings and into the trustee committees the foremost and brightest spokesman for both sides of every issue before the institution, where those issues relate to trustee policy decisions. Mr. Bassett suggested yesterday that the president adds to his empire by manipulating trustees and or usurping their responsibilities, and that this is understandable. I'd say it's a very stupid college president who thinks that that's what's happening. No president undermines his own efforts or harms the college by bringing the trustees into creative dialogue with the constituencies whom the trustees serve. The president must educate the faculty constantly and continuously to the policies of the institution and the reasons for them. He must listen to the counter reasons for counter policies from the faculty, and sometimes the faculty will see a reason why the present policy can't work anymore or was wrong in the first place. And if they have, then of course the president should undertake to have this man present his own case to see if the policy should be changed. The president must educate the public to the purposes of the university. If the purposes are worthy and understood by the public, the funds will be forthcoming. And the legitimate university prerogatives will be cherished and sustained by the public. Third failure of leadership: attend to the tough issues. It is because we have not had creative leadership, I suggest, at our universities that the race issue is such a mess today. The president who does his homework would have read, or certainly have called to his attention last spring, an article by Lerone Bennett in Ebony Magazine, in which he did a rundown of the black student organizations on campuses. And in that article, he suggested that most of these black student organizations are trying for one of two things: either progressively increase special privileges or to close the place down. Okay, if that's what's coming at you, you ought to prepare yourself for it and try to think through what is the mission of your university and how does it relate to this difficulty that's coming at us. President Weil at Roosevelt University has had the courage to stand up and say that institution is colorblind. That's the policy institution, and they're going to stick with it. There are no special privileges for whites or blacks or yellows or reds. If that is the case, here you see, understanding the mission of the university, then you can start making some judgments. Now, I'm going to suggest a heresy here, but we're going to have to be rescued from our present condition by a few heresies. If indeed colorblindness is a policy of the university, Then have you any business bringing to your campus a Dick Gregory? I quote to you from the Galesburg Register Mail newspaper, May 8, 1968, Dick Gregory said on a campus, quote, "We're going to bring this country to its knees. We're going to burn your houses down one by one. You'd better take that money you're buying us off with and buy guns to defend yourself." I want to read you a quote from Eldridge Cleaver. I will be translating one word. You will recognize it as we come to it. This is from the Berkeley Barb. If you've never seen a copy of the Berkeley Barb, believe me, you should. Or any of the 500 high school underground papers now in existence. Eldridge Cleaver speaking. 1968 is the year of the pig, the death of the ballot, the birth of the bullet. Here is the choice, contemptuously thrust in our face by the decadent racist power structure. Incidentally, this is from last October. Racist pig Humphrey, racist pig Nixon, racist pig Wallace for president. So where do we go from here? Into the streets, into the alleys, back of town, onto the rooftops. Find whatever shelter remains for a black person here in Babylon. This is the nightmare election year of the American dream. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party have told black people to kiss the ass of the elephant and the donkey. They have done this in no uncertain terms. It's time for black people to tell the elephant and the jackass to go engage in sexual intercourse, each other. Political and moral cretins they are. Yet we cannot sit idly by and allow these vipers to run their game on us without even raising a dead finger in opposition. This shit isn't funny. These pigs are plotting our death. These vicious reprobates, conniving scoundrels are plotting genocide against us, and so on. Now I ask you whether a responsible intellectual institution has any business whatever bringing a Dick Gregory or an Eldridge Cleaver to its campus as a speaker and lending the dignity and the responsibility of that platform. Get scholars to present this literature and analyze it. But why should an institution that, as a matter of fundamental policy, is colorblind bring to the campus a spokesman whose platform purpose is to stir up racial hatred? I cannot understand that. I think it is a default of leadership. SDS, tough issue of our times. The SDS, it has been repeatedly said, held a workshop at the University of Michigan one of the universities in Michigan last summer. One of the programs there was how to manufacture and use Molotov cocktails. Why should an institution committed to rational purposes ever give its official blessing to an agency publicly committed to the use of violence? If you have the purposes of the university clearly in mind, it seems to me you have no choice but to say violence is antithetical to the educational process. We will not tolerate individual violence, and we certainly will not tolerate organized violence or the preaching of organized violence on our campus. Drugs. I heard a statement by Professor Alpert, who was Timothy Leary's associate and sidekick, to a group of educators, deans. He told us that he had used LSD 235 times himself, that he was an expert on it, and that it was a fine thing and expanded the mind. And then he said to that audience, if you believe in academic freedom, you are obliged to bring Tim Leary or me to come speak to your students so they can know firsthand the beauties of LSD, psychedelic drugs. Now, the thing that appalled me about that situation was not that he said this, but you can sort of sense from the audience, and it appeared as if the people there seemed to agree that this was one of the obligations of academic freedom. Crisis, again, to which the academic community has, in my judgment, failed miserably. We have, in the last year or two, seen a transition in the public attitudes, or at least on the attitude part of a large portion of the public, particularly the young, a change from an enthusiasm for civil disobedience to an outright unconcern with law. I chaired a meeting of high school students talking about marijuana 2 weeks ago. And a lot of students in the audience, they were talking about how much marijuana was used in their high schools. They were interested in discussing the physical and psychological consequences of using marijuana. And I said, what about the legal consequences? And I said, you know, it's a felony in this state to buy, sell, or distribute marijuana. So what? I said, perhaps you don't realize that if you are convicted of a felony, you can never vote again, you can never hold public office, and you are foreclosed from most positions of responsibility. They were absolutely open-mouthed, incredulous. They'd never heard this. And they were sure I was wrong. Fortunately, the chief of police was sitting right there, and he said, yeah, it's true. Now, if an academic community takes the public position that the students may smoke marijuana if they want while this is a felony, what they're saying is, go ahead, commit felonies. We couldn't care less. As far as I'm concerned, this is totally irresponsible on the part of an agency that is supposed to serve society. We don't have time to go on. There are others, I think, that certainly the age gap, everybody writes about the age gap, nobody talks about its consequences. Again, educational leadership should be thinking about the consequences. If young people only talk to each other about the things that frighten them and frustrate them and their anger at you and me for failing to make a better society into which they're coming, it's no wonder that a large and growing portion of the brightest students see society as hopeless and withdraw, come hippies and smell of flowers, or see society as hopeless, become the cynics and live it up because what have we got to lose, or look at society, see it's hopeless, and become the revolutionaries and want to tear it down. The brightest ones. It seems to me that the only hope for affirmative leadership to come out of the younger generation is if the young people are engaged in creative activities with people of older generations who've lived through war, suffered death in the family, overcome personal reversals, and still see purpose in life and some joy in life and some reasons for standing up tall in the face of problems. If the educational institutions, particularly those of higher learning dealing with that age group, are not active in bringing these young people into creative work with the older generations, we deserve what we get. I'm pretty well used up my time. I'm not going to get into this area of defending integrity in any extent other than to say that the higher educational leadership, so-called, in this country is guilty, in my judgment, of a fantastic default in its enthusiasm for federal funds. If they'd done their homework, they would have recognized that up until about 1950, every college and university president in this country was publicly and passionately opposed to the use of direct federal funding. The reasons which they gave at that time were all valid and have since been proven the truth. You can't be dependent and independent at the same time. It doesn't work. If you've got a separation of church and state, as state moves in, church must move out. We've seen all the one university after another getting rid of its board of trustees composed of priests or clergy or whatever. Defending the integrity. The codification of rights, this recent Bill of Student Rights, and this was passed by all of the agencies of higher education, American Council on Education, Association of Deans, and so forth. In that codification of student rights, it says a student may bring any speaker to the campus under any circumstances at any time that the student group thinks appropriate. This, then, having been endorsed, suppresses the minority view. But what this means is the trustees, the administration, and the faculty have responsibility without authority, if the students have that right. To conclude, many presidents have been largely absorbed in the task of just keeping the institution going. Now, many of them are totally absorbed in just keeping the institution together. I suggest the sickness of our society is not the cause of the crisis of impotence and confusion on campus, not the fall of the sickness of society, but the reverse. The confusion and impotence on campus is to a great extent the cause of the sickness in society. Before I close, I do want to say this. I served General Eisenhower twice, once in the 1st Infantry Division in World War II, once as Executive Vice Chairman of his Committee on Government Contracts in Washington. When we were fighting in the Army, we knew what we were fighting for. With his leadership, not administration, but leadership, the fighting troops and the people at home had a very clear idea of what was at stake. There was a well-organized, well-planned presentation of what was at stake. When we served in the Committee on Government Contracts again, with Ike as our chief, as a leader, we knew exactly what was at stake as we were working in this tough business of the rights of minorities in jobs that were paid for by the federal government. That was leadership. And was it suggested yesterday, history so far has misjudged General Eisenhower as a leader. If the academic leadership will lead with courage and constancy and informed judgment, if it will consider its first job to be that of scholarship in understanding the mission of the university, and each university may well be different in the mission itself, then when you come up against tough answers, tough problems, you can find answers which are reasonable for that institution. And I think we can begin to bring some sanity to the present chaos. Thank you.